Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we check back in with the guys behind International Talk Like a Pirate Day. We find out what it was like being a heavy metal addict in the 1980s, learn about some local bloggers, and we talk to a man who recently won a meat-cutting competition. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. There's no prerequisite for setting up a weblog or blog, except for having a computer and something to say. Lots of those with their own blogs say they need to update readers on the latest in politics or take the media to task, while others simply like writing for writing's sake, and all hope others will see their work. AM580's Jeff Bossert introduces us to some local bloggers and finds out why they do it.
Look up the definition of blog on an internet browser, and the simplest answers you'll find include a personal journal on the web, or information that is instantly published to a website. University of Illinois journalism professor Eric Meyer says few blogs go beyond that.
The original notion was something that probably would have involved an author commenting on something that was reported elsewhere, and then inviting others who read his comments or her comments to comment on that. And very few of the things that we call blogs these days are actually structured that way. Most of them are more like diaries.
But a few of the bloggers in the Champaign area say they are seeking that feedback, perhaps even from one another face-to-face.
So you're
Yeah.
Hi. I'm Gail.
Hi, Gail.
Hi.
About 12 of them, some with very different themes to their blogs, recently got together for a drink and conversation downtown. Gail Hapke is a U of I English instructor. She admits there's no otherworldly purpose for her blog, Scribal Terror, but she says it's set up specifically so others will respond to her writing with their own essays, short stories, and poems.
It's meant to be a participatory thing. Rather than just me talking about my thoughts, it's me bringing up ideas and people getting involved and talking about them and conversing and so on. So I felt there was a niche for that.
Well, Hapke says she has no specific purpose for blogging other than to elicit feedback and making some friends online. Kayoshi Martinez conceived of the idea for the Champaign area bloggers to meet face-to-face. A longtime columnist for the Daily Illini, the U of I senior journalism major says he's shifted the focus of his site, called Swag Blog, from politics to personal consumerism.
What am I spending my money on as a 21-year-old male in Champaign, Urbana? You know, what are my personal expenditures? Kind of look at that. And, you know, obviously once in a while something crops up in the news that's just so big I have to say something or write something about it. So that's there too. But mainly it's to kind of look at and see what spending habits I have and just, and also kind of like let other people know about what I think is, you know, some interesting parts of pop culture.
Martinez's blog, as well as Gail Hapke's, both occasionally make reference to U.S. and world news. Jason Berrigman is one of the authors of Illini Pundit, which often mentions local figures and issues.
I try to give some commentary on kind of what's happening on the inner workings of the Republican Party and literally ask for some feedback from our readers and use the dialogue and commentary that I get in discussions that I have with other Republican leaders.
And there's a blog called It's Matt's World. Matt was at the event but wouldn't give his last name. He says his liberal focus includes news items and topics related to leading a gay lifestyle, but he welcomes comments from all parts of the political spectrum.
It's actually, I think, more interesting when conservatives respond to an argument I've made because it actually is a different point of view, and then it can spark discourse, conversation, and just kind of, you know, be a free flow of ideas.
U of I journalism professor Eric Meyer says that's all the blog really is. It's a way for someone to express his or herself, and technology will find new ways of making that happen.
One of the things that I think has fed some of the frenzy about fads online is that we think that there's some silver bullet mechanism out there, that this is the only way and this is the new way in which we will communicate. And it's really not. It's just a tool, and tools don't determine what the form of communication is.
Kiyoshi Martinez says while he hopes bloggers continue to succeed in the electronic world of communication, he plans to continue personal meetups with local and area bloggers in the future to seek some old-fashioned feedback again. I'm Jeff Bossert, AM 580 News.
Got it tuned to Sidetrack. Well, one of the most talked about interviews we've ever done on this program was one from back in September of 2003. We talked with two men, John Bauer and Mark Summers, two guys who decided to start their own holiday, that being International Talk Like a Pirate Day. For the last few years, these two have been encouraging people to speak their best pirate phrases every September 19th. I got a hold of them again recently to find out how this holiday has taken off. Back in 2003, when we talked last, International Talk Like a Pirate Day was just taking off.
And it took off.
And now, it seems to be taking over.
Well said, well said.
Yeah, we found that people all over the world are doing it, and there's nothing we can do now to stop it, even if we wanted to.
So we're just riding the wave.
So, for those who have no idea what we're talking about at this point, give us an overview of what Talk Like a Pirate Day is, and when is it?
It's September 19th every year, which is my ex-wife's birthday, and we selected it because the date was stuck in my head and we weren't doing anything with it anymore.
We weren't being mean about it.
No, not a bit. And what it is basically a day, just one day out of the year, when people drop all of the pretense of having a serious life and talk like a pirate.
Just for the sheer fun of it.
And that's it.
And that's it.
It couldn't be simpler.
When we first started doing it, basically we would call up our friends when they were at work, get them on the line, say, "Arr!" into the phone and hang up.
So it started small.
It's grown some since then.
Yeah. So, what sort of events have you guys got planned this year for Talk Like a Pirate Day?
Well, of course, we've got a new book coming out.
Yes.
So a lot of our events are built around flogging the book.
So it's just come out, called Piratitude, is that?
Piratitude.
Piratitude.
Tell me a little bit about this book.
It's your all-in-one guide to talking, being, acting, living the life of a pirate.
Swaggering and misbehaving like a pirate.
And it's a follow-up book, actually, to...
Well, that's sort of. It's 85% a follow-up book. Nothing is as simple and straightforward as you'd like it to be, I'm sorry.
But you guys...
So we self-published a book a year ago.
Right. And this was way after we guys
down,
talked.
A Guy's
right.
Guide to Talking Like a Pirate. And it was successful enough that Penguin... publishers bought the book. They bought the rights to that book, but they wanted a little bit different angle and a little bit different format. And the next thing you know, we've written a book that's twice as long. It's 85% new material. So, and we think it's, as much as we liked Well Blow Me Down, it's sort of our firstborn, and you're always proud of your firstborn. But this is a better book. It's a funnier book, and it's certainly a longer book.
You know, it strikes me a little curious that you could come up with more ways to talk like a pirate.
More words, more attitude, more piratitude.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's sort of that general lexicon that has been passed down through stories and movies and such, which everybody knows and
everybody just sort of knows it by osmosis. No one ever studied it. But everybody knows when you say, "Arr," you're talking like a pirate.
And there's so much that we've learned even since we started, when this became an international holiday. People write to us, send us emails, send us information about historical pirates, which we mix into the funny stuff that we like to say about pirates, and we come up with a kind of a pirate lore.
But the book Piratitude is about more than just talking like a pirate. It's about how to find your inner pirate and then use him to
scare people
and behave badly.
Now, I remember last time we chatted, there was a discussion, I guess, in your pirate community about, is it R or ARG?
It's a long-standing debate. Now, the English say YAR, and Americans tend to go with either R or ARG.
We stand four square on the R side. We still say ARG is what you say when you sit on a belaying pin.
But you've pretty much settled that debate.
That's right. That's done.
Now, you guys have to be overwhelmed with how big this has become.
If we allowed ourselves to stop and think about it, we couldn't even think about it. It has, like Cap'n Slappy there said, it has taken over our lives.
And this is nothing that you planned on happening.
No, we feel like a couple of pastry chefs who are sailing this monster wave. It's a lot of fun, but it's not at all what we had planned to be doing.
That's right.
Now, are you afraid at this point, if you die, while this thing is still going on, when you die, on your tombstone, it'll be the guy who created Talk Like a Pirate Day?
You know, a lot worse things could go on a tombstone.
Especially ours. We'll take that.
We'll take that one.
We'll be quite happy with that.
So have you come up with any more good pirate slogans? Anything that, sort of the casual pirate talker could use come the 19th when it is Talk Like a Pirate Day?
Well, one of my favorites of the newer words that we're using these days is monkey pump.
Which is
pirate for straw. Basically, you stick a monkey pump in a bunghole, and you suck out some of the rum. So monkey pump is both fun and a little edgy.
A little naughty, one might say, one's being a naughty pirate.
And where did that phrase come from?
That is an old nautical phrase.
That a sailor would slip a bit of straw through the staves of a barrel or through the bunghole to sneak a drink so that no one would know the barrel had been opened. It was a piratey kind of thing to do.
Have you guys gained any more insight about why this Talk Like a Pirate Day has caught on with so many people, why people gravitate towards it?
Well, the question of why pirates is really interesting to us, because we wondered that ourselves, but we think that it's because pirates were and are remembered as the freest people on Earth, that they could do or say anything and not have to be afraid of how people would react.
They laughed at custom and convention, and our lives today are so bound by convention, and people today live lives with very little swagger. And Talk Like a Pirate Day is one day a year when you can swagger.
Now, where are you guys going to be on September 19th?
We're not entirely certain yet. There is a hard-working publicist at our publisher who's trying to line things up. And we'd kind of like to know ourselves, because it's, 2 weeks away? Week and a half away? But we're hoping that wherever we'll be, they'll be talking like pirates and hoisting a tot or two of grog.
We're not in a position where we're ready to say no to either Leno or Letterman.
That either of them have asked. We'd go to Oprah if she'd take us.
Yeah, but, I mean, don't you get the feeling someday that you're just going to be, put into pirate costumes and just pushed at various talk shows and kind of...
We've done the pirate costume. We've appeared in stranger places than talk shows.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks ago, we did a day at a summer camp for children up in the Sierras, which was a lot of fun, but, oh, Lord, there was no oxygen in that air. 7,500 feet up. Woo!
And you guys in your big pirate outfits.
In pirate our outfits with swords and pistols.
And oxygen masks.
So where do you guys go from here?
Wherever they tell us to go. I mean, we're well-behaved pirates.
We actually have another book in the works that we should have finished before too long. So we're hoping to get that into the publishing ranks soon.
Can we get a preview of that one? Is there a hint of what that will be called?
We don't really have a title yet, but it's looking like it's going to be kind of a pirate self-help book.
And Lord knows pirates need help.
Like chicken soup for the pirate soul?
Chicken soup for the pirate soul.
Only even more all-encompassing. Every problem, everything wrong with you, we'll try to fix it.
Wow. If people want to learn more about International Talk Like a Pirate Day, where should they go?
They should visit our website, talklikeapirate.com. And pick up a copy of our book, Piratitude. So you want to be a pirate? Here's how.
Well, John Bauer and Mark Summers, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Don't forget, International Talk Like a Pirate Day is September 19th. A link to their website can be found on the sidetrack page of the WILL website, will.uiuc.edu. The original interview, the one we did back in 2003, can also be found on our website. This is Sidetrack. The Earth turns, but some parts of the Earth turn faster than others. An article in a recent issue of the journal Science provides evidence that the Earth's core is rotating at a rate faster than the rest of the planet. A University of Illinois scientist who co-authored the study says their findings end a 9-year debate on the question and provide more information about the Earth's magnetic field. Jim Meadows reports.
140 years ago, writer Jules Verne imagined a scientific expedition traveling to the Earth's core in his novel, Journey to the Center of the Earth. A 1959 Hollywood version presents a journey through deep caves filled with dinosaurs, lost cities, and an unknown force that snatches away the explorers' gold watches and rings.
My ring! My wedding ring!
A field of force that snatches gold away! This is it! This is it! The junction of magnetic forces from the North Pole and the South Pole, the center of the Earth!
Jules Verne had a point when he linked our planet's magnetic field with the center of the Earth. Scientists today understand that the center of the Earth contains no lost cities, but a solid core of mostly iron and nickel, surrounded by a molten outer core. University of Illinois geology professor Xiaodong Song says researchers into how the Earth's magnetic field is generated think the rotation of the core has something to do with it.
The people who are doing the so-called dynamo studies, which is the study of understanding how the Earth's magnetic field is generated, have theorized that the inner core must be moving relative to the Earth's surface.
Song, working with colleagues at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, tackled the problem of how to prove the theory that the inner core rotates at a different rate than the Earth's surface, thus generating the planet's magnetic field. Song says they found evidence of the different rotation rates by comparing the seismic waves produced by earthquakes. They looked at earthquakes of the same magnitude occurring in the same spot but years apart. Song says seismic waves from the different quakes were similar when traveling through the upper parts of the Earth, but different when traveling through the Earth's solid core, evidence that over time the core had moved relative to the Earth's surface. The key, says Song, is that the core, while solid, is not the same all the way through.
If the inner core is a uniform sphere, even if it rotates, we cannot see it. But the inner core is such that it's so complex that its properties will change from one location to another location as it rotates. We are seeing different structures, meaning a different wave speed, different scatterers at different locations.
At its estimated rate of rotation, the Earth's core might take 700 years or so to move a full rotation ahead of the rest of the Earth. Song says the rate of rotation might not be constant, and at other times the inner core might actually rotate more slowly than the rest of the planet. But he says he's gratified that a difference in rotation can be detected so clearly, with evidence spread out over just a few years.
You know, this is just the most beautiful things that I ever saw, in the sense that it turns out to be fairly simple. You can see it directly. You know, more like astronomers, they don't need to use a radio telescope, you know, to see the distant planets.
Song's latest research project involved the installation of seismic stations in the interior of Alaska to collect more data on the structure and rotation of the inner core of the Earth. I'm Jim Meadows.
Still to come on the program, we talk to a local man who recently won a meat-cutting competition, and we find out what it's like to be addicted to heavy metal music. Stay tuned. You're listening to Sidetrack. Summertime always seems to bring out stories of food-related competitions, whether it's Nathan's famous hot dog eating contest or a pie bake-off at the county fair. Well, here's a new one. Competitive meat cutting. Picture this. A dozen contestants are put into a refrigerated truck with a knife and 20 pounds of beef. The one who comes out with the most and best-looking steaks and other cuts is the winner. Well, Scott Reeves of Champaign recently won a regional meat-cutting competition put on by his employer, Texas Roadhouse, as part of their Meat Hero Challenge. He stopped by the WILL studios recently to talk about this contest and about his meat-cutting win.
The reason that we do it is to keep us all competitive and keep the stakes legendary. See, I think when you have a competitive edge on things like that, you know, it makes you better, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so when you get all the meat cutters together like that and have them compete against each other, it gives you a goal to reach, you know, or you know, bragging rights or whatever. But it also helps our store, you know, sell legendary meat. You know, we have something on the menu, you know, you read it off of there and you want it to be exactly what you see on the menu. And so in order to do that, it requires, you know, a lot of practice and a lot of care. And you have to be a little bit passionate about what you're doing. So,
well, so tell me a little bit about how this competition was set up. Well, how did it look like? What did they have you guys do?
Well, for the one that I was in this year, they had an actual refrigerated truck in the parking lot, and they had it all set up so we could all stand elbow to elbow and grind it out together, you know. But what you do is you pick a loin of each of the kind of meats that we cut, and you know, loin selection is really a big part of how you win these competitions, because you have to be able to see the loin and know what you can get the best amount of meat from and the most legendary specs, you know. And what they do is you have everybody pick and they give you a number, and the judges don't know whose meat is whose or anything like that. And you go in and they say go, you get started, you cut, and you got to come out with the most amount of steaks without wasting, you know, too much meat. And they're all measured and You know, they check them for the fat thickness, for, you know, everything, all the specs that we go by. And if you don't actually, if a steak doesn't reach your spec, it's actually tossed and removed from your score. So it's pretty tough. You have to really take some time and care in what you're doing, or, you know, one steak could blow the whole thing for you. So
you said that choosing the right piece of meat is very important. What other tricks are there to being a good meat cutter?
Let's see. I think consistency. You know, you just have to continue to do exactly the way you've done it always before. And, I don't really know. I think just being in the restaurant cutting steaks on a daily basis, you know, that's what makes you sharp more than worrying about the competition. You know what I mean? It just kind of happens when you get to the competition. If you like what you do and you try hard at work, you'll do well in these competitions.
So there's no secret sort of knife technique. There's no, you don't have an arsenal of tricks that you keep hidden. That,
well, I believe every meat cutter probably has his tricks, but, you know, we're not going to share those with each other because I've still got more competition to go.
Well, what do you think your actual strength is in being a meat cutter?
I think my strength in being a meat cutter is just that I really enjoy what I'm doing, and it's satisfactory to see the customers keep coming back. And so that's what keeps me sharp, because I want to serve legendary meat. You know, I'm not trying to hand anybody a sloppy steak for dinner. So
how did you learn how to do this? How did you get started being a meat cutter?
Well, I took a job in this restaurant, and the meat cutting wasn't my first position, but the position opened up, and I was one of the older employees, and so they asked me if I was interested in giving it a shot. They said it was a big responsibility, and I thought maybe it was a good way to get my foot in the door with the company, and so I took a shot at it, and I got to be honest, it wasn't easy, and it was very overwhelming. You know, I may cut 3,500 to 4,000 steaks, you know, in a week. So
roll in the sides of beef and give you a knife and say, go at it?
No, they actually, I think I had probably a good solid month of training, you know, from the former meat cutter, who he stood beside me, watched me, gave me his tips, his secrets, you know, and watched over me day after day after day. And that's pretty much how that went.
Yeah. Well, is it something that you ever saw yourself doing before? You know, it's, I don't know if meat cutters are born or bred. I mean, it's...
No, 2 years ago, before I started in this company, I would have never guessed that I was going to be cutting meat for a living. But now that I am, you know, I wish I would have jumped into this sooner.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's an enjoyable job. You know, it's a big responsibility, and, you know, you get a lot of respect around the restaurant for what I do, and, you know, I don't know, I just think it's overall enjoyable. I have fun when I'm at work, you know, and... I'm proud of what I do, so.
And then it turned over into this competition.
I knew nothing about competition before I started this. You know, mm-hmm. I was just in it, you know, to learn and know more about this store. And when they mentioned competition, it kind of made me nervous. I thought, well, man, there's probably a million meat cutters in the company that are good, and I didn't want to make myself look foolish. But I actually had a competition last year, and I was still a really new meat cutter then, and I didn't have a clue what was going on in the competition. I didn't do well at all. In fact, I think I took last place last year, and I decided then, though, that it was interesting competition, and I wanted to do better the next year, and I did.
So it's the thrill of the game, too, besides the skill.
Well, bragging rights between meat cutters, and call each other stores, and you know, everybody has their talk to say about each other. You know, I don't know. It's just good bragging rights.
That was Scott Reeves, who recently won a regional meat cutting competition as part of the Texas Roadhouse Meat Hero Challenge. Reeves was in St. Louis this week to compete in the next round, and we'll let you know how he did. You're listening to Sidetrack. College students have returned to school after a summer of working jobs or internships or simply enjoying some time off. But for one Western Illinois University student, the summer months were spent in a much different part of the world. Rich Edgar has this report.
This was not the first trip to Africa for Tom Cajuanez. He spent some time there on his own a year ago. This year, he proposed going to Africa as a summer class. He ended up receiving some money from the university to go, and he's writing features on daily life there. Cajuanez says Africa is much different than other places he's visited.
I had spent time in Europe before, but it was never... It was interesting, but it was never a point where you go, wow, I'm really somewhere else. So that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I did the year before, is just I went there, and it's so foreign that it's difficult to explain to someone when they ask, well, how is Africa? It's difficult to go, different, you know? There's nothing to compare it to.
So how is Africa?
Different.
Why were you interested in doing this as a journalist, going back there as a journalist?
Because I think it's looking at life there, it is completely different, yet people have the same struggles as people here in America. I took different aspects of life, like a taxi driver, and compared him to a taxi driver here. Granted, it's both the same name and description of your job on a piece of paper, but a taxi driver there rides around on a motorcycle and sometimes has, I don't know, documents to travel 4 kilometers across, and he only makes 20 cents for, you know, a certain amount of distance, where a taxi driver here might make $10.
And when we say there, I mean, we're sort of generalizing when we say Africa.
You are.
You were in specific countries.
I was. I was in Benin and Niger, which is in West Africa.
What about, how did what you saw compare with what you expected the first time you went there?
I took it for granted the first time I was there because it was more of a quick month and out, and I didn't know what to expect. The second time, or this last time when I went, I was really trying to look at how people were living. And lots of times when people say, oh, you went to Africa, are people really suffering there? Well, no, people are living. You know, it's how they live. It's ridiculous to think that you see a person who's very skinny on the television and you say, oh, my God, they're starving. No, that's part of their life. You know, they may not have a lot to eat, but that's how they get by. They're just living. They're just normal people.
But you did encounter famine when you were there this summer, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I was in Niger during the crisis that Niger asked for help from world organizations. And it's true. People do not eat a lot during 3 months in between their growing seasons. Usually they try to stockpile as much as they can from when they farm to make up for the lack of food. But with poor rains and a locust swarm eating a lot of the crop last year, they went hungry this year. But it's not uncommon for people, farmers, to go 2 or 3 days without eating. It's just that I think it might have been a slow news time, and we really took it serious this time. But it's not something we can stop by sending them a day's worth of food or a day's worth of aid or even a week's worth of aid. It's something that, you know, as an international community, we have to spend more time learning about irrigation and helping these people with more than just farming.
Well, are these global relief efforts of any help at all?
They are. I mean, the people that I encountered and I interviewed, they said, well, this is great for today. And some people actually got more than other people as far as aid. And if you found a camp with doctors and your child was completely malnourished, they would keep the child there for weeks at a time. But it's difficult because of the corruption, especially in Niger. And I'm not blaming one person or the government, and I'm not making a huge general statement. But the article I'm writing deals with the aid community can't directly distribute the aid. They go there, let's say Oxfam, which is a French organization, will go there with a large portion of aid, and they give it to the government to distribute. Because if they show up at a village to distribute it, it's mobs. There's people fighting for food. But if the government goes there to distribute it, They keep people in line. They check identity cards, things like that, and they can directly distribute it to the people. The only problem with giving it to officials or high-ranking people in the government is sometimes there's corruption, and I would see sacks of aid being sold in markets in different countries.
What did you think the first time you saw something like this?
I grabbed from my camera, and my translator looked at me, and he's like, "No, what are you doing? You can't take photos of this." He's like, "You know, we'll go talk to people. We'll talk about it. You can do interviews, but it would be slightly detrimental to your health if you took photos of people sorting aid." And
was that the way it was phrased to you?
He said he didn't know what would happen, but I could try to plead my case. But people are very emotional when they're doing something that maybe, I don't know. The way he put it was people are buying cheap food and selling it, or inexpensive food and selling it to other people that need food at inexpensive prices. So these aren't the people that were stealing it. These aren't the people that are doing anything wrong. They're just buying inexpensive food and reselling it. So that's how I took it. But it's still difficult to see a sack of rice that says a gift from the People's Republic of China being resold. It's difficult for me to see that. But he put his exact words were, it's just how it's done here.
And people seem to accept it?
Yeah, people accept it. People accept that when the truckload of inexpensive rice comes, it's inexpensive rice.
That's Western Illinois University student Tom Kashwanez, who spent the summer in West Africa. He's now writing about what he saw and plans to pitch his stories to major newspapers. Kashwanez graduates in December, and he hopes to return to Africa, perhaps even as a foreign correspondent. Rich Egger reporting.
Got attuned to Sidetrack. Big hair, spandex, loud guitars, and the whole sex, drugs, and rock and roll thing. That was the nature of heavy metal music in the late 70s and throughout the 80s. One man who felt his life was changed forever from the first moment he heard the songs of AC/DC was writer Seb Hunter. He recently chronicled his life with heavy metal in a book titled Hellbent for Leather, Confessions of a Heavy Metal Addict. It's published by Harper Perennial. I talked with him recently and asked him first how his obsession with heavy metal started and what was it about the music that called to him.
How it started? I don't know how it called to me. I remember exactly how it started. I remember it more vividly than probably anything else in my life. I was at boarding school at 10 years old, and I was, you know, I'd been exposed to pop music as young people tend to be. And I listened to it, enjoyed it, a bit of ABBA, a bit of you know what. And it was at boarding school, and it was one child, one day, just played the AC/DC single, Let's Get It Up. And I remember just it was like this kind of dreadful shiver just went through me, and I knew that what I just heard was this incredibly powerful thing that I just kind of, the physiological response was incredibly profound. And from then, I just thought, well, this is it. I found, you know, the meaning of life, and everything changed really after that.
And it became an absolute obsession for you.
Yeah, completely, completely. I mean, I'm a bit like that anyway. I think certain people are, you know, they have obsessions and they follow them. And it was. I was an intelligent kid. I was going to a good school. But as soon as I heard AC/DC, I mean, everything else in my life and education, studies, family just took sort of second place after the metal. And I just went after it. And it's like, I mean, back in those days, you know, there was no internet or anything. So you have to kind of blaze your own trail. So you just have to go to a record shop on your own look at the A section and find AC/DC, and then, you know, you hear about another band, and then you follow that band, and you're just making it up as you go along, really, just sort of finding these bands as you come to them. So you don't really choose the bands, you know. You just hope you're lucky with not getting any crap ones as you go.
It sounds almost karmic, you know. You don't choose the bands, but in some larger metal universe, they choose you.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. And, you know, you're in a record shop, and you know, I mean, look, fortunately, metal, you know, visually, it's quite unique and it's recognizable. So you would really just go to a record shop and look for record sleeves that had that sort of aesthetic, or, you know, just men with long hair. And, you know, the visual aesthetic was important as well, because sometimes, even when you were young and you didn't really know the criteria or the parameters for image and sound and what they kind of equaled, you would take a look at the back of a record sleeve and you think, well, these guys look a bit dodgy. You know, there's a keyboard player there, or there's one bloke with short hair, and I don't quite like the look of the dragon on the front. And, you know, you would sort of pick up these warning signs from an early age, and they would sort of direct you in directions or otherwise. So, you know, there was quite a lot of instinct going on as well as the karma.
Well, when you talk about, you know, looking for these signs and you know, sort of being able to parse out the record from the visuals, it really brings out this idea of social currency, where you and your friends had this language, had this this common code for what you were looking for and what metal was to you, and you were constantly on the lookout for others who spoke the same language as you.
Yeah, very much so. And a lot of the time, I don't know whether this tends to be the case for most children, but that usually the kids that know more are older, and they are sort of witheringly contemptuous of younger children who are into, you know, less cool bands than they are. So, you know, you would often try and go up to a kind of cooler older kid and say, "Do you like? Can you tell me what bands you like, or what bands you like?" And they would just, you know, they just dismiss you, you know, or sort of give you a slap round the head and just say, "Get out of my face." And they might mention a few bands that you should be into sort of contemptuously, and you'd sort of run off and try and discover them. So, no, very much. It was a big peer situation going on there as well.
And, of course, to go along with that, you were always chatting with your friends about the music, and these conversations eventually turned to, let's form a band.
Yes, exactly. I think that's always inevitable in a lot of cases, because, of course, you get to the point and your imagination is completely living within, you know, the whole band pantomime thing, and eventually you sort of grow into it and you think, well, hang on a second, it's almost like you suddenly look in the mirror and think, I could do that. And I was fortunate enough that my dad was a musician, and he had a guitar around the house and a bass, actually, which he built himself, bizarrely enough. And I suddenly just—I remember listening to Kiss, you know, about, well, how old was I? About 13 years old, and just thinking, you know, I could be Gene Simmons too. That classic, you know, a moment of empowerment. And it doesn't matter if you can't play. I mean, of course you can't play. You just pick it up and you hold this guitar or bass in front of the mirror, and that's one—that's one of the most powerful. That's probably as powerful, if not more so, than the original kind of hearing the heavy metal music moment itself. You know, when you realize, you know, my God, you have a guitar in your hands, and you—you know—it doesn't matter if you can play it or not. It's just, you know, you can learn to play it. That's not the important thing. The fact is, it's in your hands.
Well, in fact, that music was almost second to band image, the logo, the name.
Yeah, all the trappings. I mean, that's the great thing about metal. You know, I mean, it is its own universe, and of course, it has its complete own set of visuals and aesthetics. And you can you know, you when you start your own band, even if you can't play your instruments, even if there's just two of you, which there were of us, it was just me and my friend Paul, and we argued because we both played the bass originally. So eventually one has to give in and agree to play the guitar. And of course, you know, that's the most important and exciting thing, choosing the name, choosing the song titles, writing stupid lyrics, and getting a logo sorted out as well.
So tell us about the first band you formed.
Well, it was inauspicious. We were called Armageddon's Ring, which we thought was very cool and very, you know, very sort of scary and big and epic and also quite violent. And it was just the two of us. And that was it, really. And then we got another guitarist who came along, but who actually couldn't play the guitar. And he played a guitar solo completely, you know, I mean, just couldn't play. He just whacked at his strings. And there was a lot of that going on. It was just kind of posing around. And then I think actually in the end our parents banned us from seeing each other. I only found out that recently when I got back in touch with Paul again. He told me that our parents were so dismayed at our kind of musical collaboration that they actually banned us from being friends anymore. But I must have deleted that from my memory.
But it didn't stop you at all from...
No, it didn't stop. No, absolutely.
So you went on through a series of other sorts of bands.
Yes.
And during this time, your taste in metal really changed from,
yes,
from the old guard of the 1970s to what was coming up in the 1980s, all the big hair bands.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, that's what tended to happen in the 80s. You know, it's suddenly metal, which it had all been relatively together. Everyone was on the same kind of boat, you know, from the early 60s all through the 70s, early 80s, and then suddenly these two strands came left and right. You had the thrash metal, you know, your Metallicas and your Slayers and Anthrax, and then you had your glam stuff, you know, Motley Crue and Rat and the big hair stuff. And I was dreadfully excited by all the big hair stuff. I just thought it was, you know, I just thought it was amazing. I suppose it came out of Kiss. It depends where you come out of, you know, what kind of music you come out of and you're sort of looking towards. But I got into Kiss, and then I got into Aerosmith, and that whole kind of early Aerosmith look, that sort of Stones, debauched silk scarves and hats and all that sort of thing. I was just, you know, the whole pirate look, you know, buccaneer type thing. And I was just, I just went head over heels in it. And that sort of led me to bands like Rat and onto things like Poison and other not so proud bands, of which there were many. And they're all back. They're all reformed again now, aren't they? They're all playing again.
Yeah, pretty much. But, I mean, you couldn't escape those hair metal bands in the 80s. They were everywhere.
Yeah, they were, absolutely. And they were cool as well. That was the thing. I remember when MTV was starting, they were playing, like, Rat videos and Motley Crue. And they were, you know, I mean not cool, but, I mean, they were pretty credible. I mean, it was a good place to be before it all got a bit silly with Poison and just, you know, a million bands came out of L.A. But no, there was a time when it was you know, it wasn't laughable to be into the hair metal stuff, but soon it was.
Well, tell us about your life as a hair metal guitar player and the bands that you formed and how those bands took shape and how they evolved and disintegrated and the whole bit.
Well, the first band I was in the hair metal style, I mean, I was very much, you know, I was completely hook, line and sinker in the hair metal. You know, I had the tattoo and the sort of spray on jeans and the bangles and the, you know, the headbands, the cowboy boots, the whole thing. And because I was so completely obsessed with that look and everything, in Winchester, which is a small town where I'm from in southern England, no one else really looked like that. It was all a bit try hard, you know, everyone else just had trainers and leather jackets and stuff. So I was desperately trying to drag my band to look as much like me as they possibly could, and of course no one really had any much interest in it. So there was, you know, in all our photos, there's me looking like this terrible kind of terrible sort of rock tart, and everyone else is just sort of standing around slightly embarrassed. And I thought, you know, they're trying so hard to be like me, but I look back now and I'm like, oh god, you know, they were just thinking, who is this bloke dressing like a woman? You know, we've got gigs to play. And after that, you know, I realized that Winchester was much too small for a talent like mine. So I decided to move to London, you know, bright lights and all that sort of stuff when I was 18. And that didn't go very well. I mean, you know, I suppose it's the same for anyone. You move to a big city, you've got no money, you can't even eat, you haven't got anywhere to live, and it's just this kind of desperate situation, and it's just really not very much fun. And then I joined, it's all in bizarre kind of circumstances and coincidences. I joined this band called Cat Ballou in London, and we were very, you know, there's a band called the Dogs d'Amour. It was all that kind of sleazy, cowboy booty, kind of chic type thing going on. And we started taking lots of drugs and living the whole lifestyle thing, which of course was just as important as the music. I mean, to be honest, I mean, even though I was quite eager, I mean, I was into the image and stuff, music was always the defining thing for me. I took my musicianship and guitar playing very, very seriously. But unfortunately, as soon as I got to London, the band I joined, music was about fourth down their list of most important things, you know, behind taking drugs, looking good, attitude, running a rock club, and, you know, practicing and actually, you know, being musicians was kind of a bit passé, you know, so I clearly sort of joined up with the wrong crowd.
Well, actually, that's pretty much how every metal band was,
yeah,
at that time. So, I mean, maybe in some way you were the exact right crowd. Because
I suppose so, but the right way around to do it is to make sure, I mean, even Guns N' Roses, you know, when they were,
sure,
their sort of huge chemical excesses at the beginning, they, you know, at least they wrote killer songs and they toured and they played gigs and they honed their art and their craft so that, you know, that it was only after they'd done all this great music and these great shows that they kind of then sort of expressed themselves chemically, shall we say. So I think we had the things the wrong way around. You know, we got into the whole lifestyle stuff before we'd actually done the music. And I was sort of slightly aware of the absurdity of this wrong way around of doing things at the time. But, of course, everyone was just so busy partaking that it was just kind of, you know, it became bad form to protest.
Well, you had these metal dreams, these dreams of those huge arenas with the pyrotechnics and swinging off the stage.
Yeah, and you just assume it's going to happen to you. You just do. I mean, there was the film, The Decline of Western Civilization, Part 2, The Metal Years. I remember we all used to, it was all these kind of glam hopefuls from L.A., And they were all kind of lining up, and they were all saying, you know, oh, you know, I'm going to be famous. And the interviewer would say, oh, what happens if you don't become famous? And they all just said, oh, but I will become famous. It was almost like incredulous, you know. What do you mean? I'm just going to, and of course, nothing happened to them. And I remember we were all sitting watching this film in London thinking, oh, look at those losers. You know, we're going to be famous, not them. But I think to live that sort of lifestyle and to be like that, you have to deeply believe that. You have to have this kind of innate knowledge that you will be famous and you will have the pyro and you will have all the shows, because otherwise you just wouldn't get up in the morning.
But that doesn't happen for a good majority of the people.
No, and what happens is that people sort of then tend to, it's like almost like a living nightmare or something. People just wake up and you just think, oh, hang on a second, you know, this just isn't working for me. And of course, a lot of people, they take too many drugs or bad things happen, or a lot of people fall by the wayside. I mean, that's well documented, which is a terrible shame. But a lot of people, they just think, well, you know, I've tried this now, it's not working for me, I'm going to, you know, and they just get a job. You know, in the end, there's only so much poverty and living on the breadline and begging for money and everything you can take. You know, it's bad for the soul. So in the end, people just get a job and it becomes a bit part-time and off they go. But with around the time when we were doing all this was like 1990 in London, there was one, you know, big specific event which destroyed everything. So in the end, we didn't actually have to get bored with it or become fed up. It was Kurt Cobain, of course, came along and just destroyed the whole metal scene virtually overnight.
Yeah, grunge did that.
It did, yeah. Totally. And it wasn't just in the States. I mean, of course, it happened to big style for bands like Motley Crue and, you know, all the big metal bands who were around at the time, the big hair guys who were just so bloated, you know. I mean, they just had it so easy for so long. I don't think they saw it coming. And, of course, you know, grunge just swept all that away. But it happened in, you know, rock music all over the world, you know, the 1990s. It just destroyed it completely. It was bizarre. I'm not sure. I mean, I suppose punk did a lot, and punk swept away a lot of the kind of Pink Floyd excesses. But I don't know if I know of a musical movement that had such a profound influence quite so suddenly as grunge did. You know, I mean, it was almost overnight.
And it changed. I mean, it changed you. You cut your hair. You became more like that style. It had such a really profound effect on you, much like the early metal did in your young years.
I mean, I was right for the change because, you know, there's only so much, because the whole thing about metal is you're only really allowed, it was much more tribal in those days. I think these days you're allowed to kind of have, you know, be a lot more eclectic in what you listen to, but, you know, we're locked in this kind of only being able to listen to certain music and certain kind of, it has to have that guitar sound for so long, and I was sick of the scene and the drugs and the lifestyle. It just wasn't working. And I remember just this music coming along and other music and just being able to open my ears to things that weren't kind of traditional, kind of the kind of music we listened to. And I was just blown away by it. I was just like, my God, you know, there is a life outside this metal, you know, and it wasn't particularly great, the metal at the time. And I just fell, you know, wholeheartedly in love with Kurt Cobain and what he was doing. And, you know, and yeah, cut my hair into a bob, had the little cardigan, the whole nine yards, got rid of my fancy Les Paul into a, you know, cheap guitar. And yeah, and in the end, you know, I joined another band and just had another bad experience. I think in the end with me, it was my constitution wasn't strong enough. I just wasn't good enough at doing the whole sex, drugs, and rock and roll thing. I was too much of a, I don't know, a coward at heart. In the end, I just sort of dropped out and met the love of my life and in the end sort of had to hang up my guitar, resign.
Well, tell us how your book, Hellbent for Leather, came about, the sort of retrospect of the looking back, the memoir of your metal years. How did this come about?
Well, it's strangely, really. I mean, it was. I never really had any idea or plans to kind of to write this book. It just kind of, the idea literally just suddenly came to me one day. I remember I was walking down the street and I suddenly thought. I mean, you know, because you've got these biographies of Lemmy and you've got autobiographies rather. You know, you've got the Motley Crue book, you've got Lemmy's autobiography, Gene Simmons, and you know, rock star autobiographies are very much a type. You know. And they're very entertaining, but I had the idea maybe I could sort of do a memoir of the flip side of that, you know, someone, one of these people who, which of course more people can identify with, I suppose, the memoir of someone who doesn't make it, you know, sort of, I suppose, the memoir of the metal failure. And the idea just came to me straight away, and I thought, well, I could do it quite, you know, because I wanted to write a funny book, and I wanted it to be amusing and blah, blah, blah. And I'm very honest. I mean, the whole point of the book is it's very honest, and it's, you know, the deep shame that comes with many stages in my metal career is all sort of laid out for the reader to enjoy at their leisure. And I thought at the same time I could do a sort of irreverent or metal primer for non-metal fans, or even for metal fans, just as entertainment, really, sort of covering the basic trappings of the genre, you know, the clothes to wear, the guitar solos, the album, the double live albums, no keyboards, all the kind of the metal lore stuff. I thought I could write about that quite, you know, make it quite amusing. And so I just stuck it all together and I got a book deal. So it was all a bit like a fairy story, really.
Well, in the current edition of your book, the the paperback version. You have some extra stuff in the back about what has happened after the publishing of this book. And one of the things, which I thought was really quite fun, is you got one of the old bands back together.
We did.
What was that like, you know, 10 years on?
It was absolutely fantastic. It was truly, truly wonderful. It was almost worth writing the book, the whole thing, just for that. It was the Trash Can Junkies, which was, I suppose, my most the last band I was in Winchester, so my last kind of small town band, and probably my favorite band that I was in. And I mean, it was just fantastic. And I got hold, we got hold of everyone, and everyone was up for doing it. And we hadn't seen each other for years and years and years. And we rehearsed. It was just, it's just total self-indulgence, but it was just fantastic. It was just like, going back in time and playing all your old songs. And we were actually really quite good. And we played at, there's a venue in London called the Highbury Garage where proper bands play. I saw Sebado. Decent bands play there. And we hired it out and we played about half an hour. And everyone who was there expected us to be completely awful and, came along to laugh. And in fact, we thought we were going to be awful as well. But I don't know what it was. It was some weird thing happened. It was really loud, and we had loads of lights and smoke and everything, and we were actually really good, and people were just completely blown away. I'm in danger of over-egging this, but, we were surprisingly good. People would come up after us and say, you were actually quite good, and we were like, I know, I don't know what's going on. And then we did it again afterwards, and we were terrible the second time, so we learned our lesson in the end.
Well, where does metal and these experiences fit into your life now?
Oh, that's a good question. I suppose since writing the book, I've re-entered the metal world. I mean, I'm still just as big a music fan. I mean, it's still my big obsession. I still play a little bit, and I'm still buy tons and tons of CDs. It's still my big love of my life. But I suppose the writing of this book and the kind of the publicity and stuff I've done in the wake of it, I've listened to a lot more metal than I otherwise would, and I've got into a lot of stuff that I wouldn't otherwise have got into, like some contemporary metal bands and some doomy current death metal and stuff. And I've kind of embraced that side of music like I really hadn't before. So it's been good in that sense. And it's enabled me to fall back in love with stuff, the early classic stuff, AC/DC and Black Sabbath and Van Halen, all the kind of the Zeph, all that kind of stuff, and listen to it with new ears. So it's been a great experience, really. And, people say, oh, you must be so bored of talking about heavy metal. I'm like, no, I love it,
That was Seb Hunter, author of Hellbent for Leather, Confessions of a Heavy Metal Addict. It's currently out in paperback and is published by Harper Perennial. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website. Just go to WILL.UIUC.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. And we've just started podcasting the show as well. That can also be found on our website, WILL.UIUC.edu. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL Urbana.